the ability to utilize ex-presidents as statesmen and deploy them around the world is both a great symbol of democracy. It's also an incredible opportunity to show national unity.
That's author Jared Cohen, assessing the unique and essential role former American presidents can play in the world. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. Currently an executive at Goldman Sachs, Jared Cohen is a former advisor to two secretaries of state and the author of five books.
Look, I think with ex-presidents, I don't think we want them wandering around like the disenchanted ghosts that Hamilton worried about.
His latest book, Life After Power, examines seven post-presidencies, starting with one of the earliest.
Jefferson is a story of a lifelong founder who managed to accomplish his third volume in his life trilogy at the age of 82.
He writes of presidents whose legacies have been celebrated and maligned.
What people don't realize about Hoover is he does recover his name in his lifetime. It just gets tarnished again posthumously.
And of those who have successfully redefined themselves after exiting the Oval Office.
It's Jimmy Carter who really invents the idea of the former presidency being a platform in and of itself. He's not done with politics. He weighs in on everything to the great agony of his successors on both sides.
As well as one who may represent a cautionary tale for Donald Trump in his bid to return to the White House.
Grover Cleveland's story of a comeback is a reminder that it might feel or seem nice to get the job you once had back, but it is rarely as sweet the second time.
Jared Cohen, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret.
Your new book, Life After Power, examines the post-presidencies of seven U.S. presidents. As you write in the book, the post-presidency is not an official office. Former presidents have no formal power, but they have a status in American life that never goes away. What was worth examining about the American post-presidency?
Well, for starters, all of us are going to ask questions about what we do next at every stage of our lives. So it's kind of the big elusive question, and you never know what the big get is or what the big job is when you're going to transition to retirement. It's interesting, you look at the presidency, there's no more dramatic retirement. And people look at Harvard Business Review case studies and entrepreneurs and business leaders. These presidents are these sort of seemingly unrelatable figures, but they fall hard and they come back down to earth and they all of a sudden become relatable. We just skip that part in the really kind of 1,000-page biographies. And to me, it's fascinating. The founding fathers didn't know what to do with ex-presidents. One of my favorite, you know, stories about this is Hamilton and the Federalist Papers, you know, sort of asked the question, is it a good idea to have half a dozen men wandering around the Republic like disenchanted ghosts? And they never quite resolved it. And here we are more than 200 years later, and we still kind of don't know what to do with our ex-presidents.
You call the post-presidency essential to America's form of government. Why?
Well, former presidencies are a remarkable feature of a democracy, right? There's a lot of authoritarian systems around the world that don't subscribe to the idea of a former president, or if they do, that former president is behind bars or, you know, suffers a worse fate. And so my view is that the idea of an ex-president, it's a feature of a democracy, not a bug. It's something to be celebrated. It's something to be understood. It's something to learn from. And look, ex-presidents, they can either be their successor's greatest ally or they can be their successor's greatest adversary and everything in between.
And they have been. Okay, so you focus on President Thomas Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, Grover Cleveland, William Howard Taft, Herbert Hoover, disclaimer later, Herbert Hoover, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush. I'm going to get to all of them individually, but in terms of broad themes, is there a common experience in the loss of power, in the transition from the presidency to that of an ordinary citizen? As you said, they fall hard, fast. A grieving that accompanies the experience of all post-presidents.
If I look at the post-presidency, I would say that there's a separation challenge that they all encounter, particularly in those early years. It's very hard to watch the person who comes in after you, whether you were voted out of office or you termed out. There's some element of dismantling your legacy in real time while you're still alive. It's a very difficult thing for ex-presidents to encounter. And then just by nature, as an ex-president, you're more muzzled than you are as president, right? You're just constrained by not having the power and the platform. And so there's a real transition. That transition is physical. That transition is mental. That transition is psychological. And there's this concept. There's this concept for astronauts called the overview effect, where before they go into space, they think about normal issues. Then they come back from space, and they can only think about grand issues like world hunger and world peace. It's the opposite for presidents. Right, their day-to-day is consumed by the most significant and macro issues that are the contemplation of former astronauts. And then they come back down to Earth and they have to deal with their finances, severed relationships, the loss of power, kind of just the mundane boredom of life. All of a sudden, they're staring mortality in the face. And watching all of them grapple with it and kind of getting in the heads of these former presidents as they kind of figured out how to make sense of this new chapter, all of them go through some kind of a struggle.
The transition, I would imagine, is handled differently by different individuals, I think, as reflections of their character and personality. But you've come up with essentially different models, right? That there are essentially seven models for the post-presidency. What have you learned?
What I've learned is there's no blueprint for this. Whether you're a president of the United States or, transitioning from a business role or some other role, whether it's towards the end of your life or in the middle of your life, there's no blueprint for what to do next, right? So if I look at the seven presidents that I focus on, for some of them, it was very deliberate. Thomas Jefferson was a serial founder. He always knew that he wanted to found a great university. John Quincy Adams, had no idea what he was going to do next. And in a much lower station, he found a much higher calling as an abolitionist, ex-president in the House of Representatives. George W. Bush never knew that he was going to, become so passionate about painting that it would, he'd be a painter longer than he was a politician. And so, what I find interesting is the seven presidents I focus on, they have certain things in common in terms of the transition, but they all got after it in very different ways. And they all represent an archetype for how to answer the question of what do we do next?
You mentioned Thomas Jefferson, and his proudest legacy was the formation of the University of Virginia, one of the longest running public universities in the country, one of the highest performing public universities in the country for its 200 years in existence. His motivation for its founding was that he believed the United States would endure if it had an educated citizenry. And that was seminal to the longevity of the Founders Project. Many lament that we have failed to pass on civics education and, frankly, a highly educated citizenry to the next generation, that there has been a decline in this project. Would Jefferson see it that way?
I think Jefferson would be heartbroken by what he sees at universities today. I think he would be heartbroken at the decline of, authority and principle at the top. And, Jefferson has three things etched on his tombstone, and it does not include being president. It's author of the Declaration of Independence and the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, which he did before he was president, and it's father of the University of Virginia. And Jefferson was a co-founder of the Republic, and he understood the flaws that they were leaving the next generation with, and he believed you needed a great arts and science university in the United States to train the next generation to be able to carry the torch and iterate on the flaws that they left behind. And what's fascinating is Jefferson, at 82 years old, finally opens the doors of UVA, and that inaugural class within 6 months puts on masks and starts rioting throughout his beloved university, which he personally designed, chanting "Down with university professors." They threw bags of urine at professors. They beat one with his cane, leaving him kind of bloodied and humiliated. And the best part of this story, which I think is a nice juxtaposition for what's happening today, the students wouldn't give each other up in some kind of, show of Southern honor. So the next day, Jefferson calls an all-school assembly for the students to meet before the disciplinary committee of the university. And the disciplinary committee of the University of Virginia in 1825 was Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. It's like the most intimidating disciplinary committee, past, present, and future. And Jefferson, at 82 years old, stands up, and he starts to speak, and the words can't come out. He's just bawling, tears pouring down his 82-year-old wrinkled face. And James Madison, who was all of 5'1", reaches up to put his hand on his shoulder. Jefferson sits down, and before Madison can get a single word out, the students, so awestruck by seeing Thomas Jefferson break down in tears one by one, confessed. So I would say, Jefferson's UVA was kind of patient zero for uprisings at American universities, but, gone are the days where just the sort of the image and the symbolism of a figure of that stature commanding that much respect would cause students to basically confess.
If you have, and I want to ask you this for each president, but if you have a one-line tagline for each post-presidency, how do you characterize Thomas Jefferson's?
So to me, Thomas Jefferson is a case study for people who fancy themselves serial founders and entrepreneurs. You know, he co-founded the Republic. He didn't want to be president. He didn't want to be vice president. He didn't want to be secretary of state. He tried to retire three different times. And what's interesting is for anybody who's a founder, there's certain obligations that come with it, right? So sometimes your company gets acquired and you're sort of stuck serving at the new parent company for 3 years when you don't want to, or you've got another idea, but you can't leave your baby behind. And that was Jefferson's problem. He kept getting drawn back into the first great thing that he founded. And all he wanted was to go and found this great university. He had other things he wanted to do as well. He had his little gadgets and experiments. But Jefferson is a story of a lifelong founder who managed to accomplish his third volume in his life trilogy at the age of 82.
John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams, the second president, is the only former president who went on to serve in the House of Representatives. He served 9 terms, almost 2 decades. Explain the circumstances of Adams' trajectory in elected life and then his fall to ordinary citizen and his return.
Well, first of all, it's worth noting, so John Quincy Adams, who gets his first job appointed by George Washington in his administration, dies in his 9th term in the House of Representatives as an ex-president in 1848, serving alongside Abraham Lincoln, a freshman congressman from Illinois. So talk about
and he dies at his desk in the Capitol.
And actually, I'm told that the couch is still in the speaker's suite. So the story of John Adams is a story of somebody who had a great second act. His presidency was a one-term intermission between two of the greatest acts in American history. The first act was a top-down one. It was architected for him by his famous parents, John and Abigail Adams, that was designed to make him president one day. And his presidency is a disaster from day one because he engages in this kind of so-called corrupt bargain with Henry Clay in the Senate when the 1824 election goes to the goes to Congress for a decision. And so he leaves office in 1829 after being defeated in a very humiliating way by Andrew Jackson and doesn't know what to do. And he's already been president. He's been Secretary of State. He's even served in the Senate. They convince him to go back and serve as an ex-president in the House of Representatives. And he doesn't know how to do anything but serve. I mean, he's sort of a baby of service. And so he takes a much lower station. And in that much lower station, a much higher cause ends up finding him. He'd always been opposed to slavery, but he becomes this champion of a cause that at the time was seen quite fringy, which is abolition.
He was from Massachusetts. He represented the state of, congressional district in the state of Massachusetts. You write, he was not trying to move up the ladder, and so he had nothing to lose in the House. He used his position to advance a cause that he came to care quite deeply about, abolition. Was he effective at sparking debates about abolition and the moral clarity, and have espoused what he viewed as a real moral clarity around abolition? Because he had been a past president, because he had already served in the highest station in his land, and because he wasn't worried about his next reelection at that point, he had secured his seat.
So John Quincy Adams had 2 things going for him. One, he was an ex-president in the House of Representatives, so it was this lowly position. He kind of had nothing. He had nothing left to prove. He was just happy to be in public service, even if he didn't necessarily know what to do with it. But his age was also an advantage because these were the days where, the gloves came off, the guns came out, and people fought each other in the House of Representatives. And over a contentious issue like slavery, there's no shortage of members of the House who said, had he not been such of an old man, they would have socked him right in the head. What's interesting about Adams is, he gets to the House of Representatives. He doesn't go back to the House of Representatives because he cares about abolition or he knows what he's going to do. In those early years, he just sort of reads petitions as they come in, because that's what you did as a member of Congress back then. And so it just so happens that some of these petitions were for abolition of the slave trade in Washington, D.C., causes for emancipation, et cetera. And so he starts reading these petitions as just kind of a mundane thing. And the reaction from the slaveocracy in the House of Representatives really outrages him because people didn't talk about slavery in the House. It was just the norm not to. And the more outrage they got, the more of an affront he thought it was to something he very much believed in, which is the right to petition. And so the more angry they got, the more petitions he read, the more petitions he read, the more petitions came in. And it ends up basically being him against everybody. And he's just so much smarter than all of these mediocre men in the House of Representatives. In his 9 terms, it's just, it's a story of them trying to censure him, doing it twice, him outfoxing them. Every time they tried to create new rules, you know, the gag rule where you couldn't talk about slavery, he finds clever ways to get around it. And so it's a story of an ex-president with just an outsized brain who was able to deploy that brain in service of the abolitionist cause in the House of Representatives. And he, as an ex-president, in the House, he became bigger than the House. He became bigger than the presidency. And I really do not believe that Abraham Lincoln would have been inspired in the way that he was had it not been for John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams mainstreamed the movement. He stepped into it. He did it by accident. He resisted it at different stages. And the movement was served by that, because by the time he embraced it, which really comes when he defends a group of slaves in the famous Amistad case before the Supreme Court, the movement is ready to be mainstreamed.
Grover Cleveland is another president who returns to elected office. He didn't do so well in the post-presidency, so he returned to the presidency. But the country had changed in the intervening 4 years. And the piece that stood out to me most about that chapter is that the downside of being reelected to the presidency is you are elected as a lame duck. Is that a cautionary tale?
So Grover Cleveland's the story of a comeback, right? And from athletes to business people to politicians, you know, one of the things that's interesting, very few people actually do it or ultimately try to do it, but everybody kind of contemplates, you know, should I go back and try to get my old job back? Grover Cleveland's the only man to ever serve as president twice. He was both the 22nd and the 24th president of the United States. And he never wanted to be president. He actually was never happier than when he lost the presidency in 1888 for a couple of reasons. One, he entered the presidency as a bachelor and got married to the love of his life, also the youngest first lady in history at 21 years old, which is its own separate complicated story that I don't think will age well. But all he wanted was to leave office and start a family and be with the love of his life and go fishing. And he basically throws away the presidency in 1888, taking a principled stance against hiking the tariff. And tariffs sort of sound boring these days, but back then it was a very contentious issue. And, you know, he didn't lose the popular vote. You know, he won the popular vote and he lost the Electoral College. He lost it on principle. And so he left office feeling popular, feeling in love, feeling like he'd taken a principled stand. And then 2 things happen in the interregnum. One, he's looking at his successor, Benjamin Harrison, drive the country into economic ruin, the first $1 billion budget, concerns about, a move to push the United States off the gold standard. And his wife wants to go back to the White House. You know, she tells the White House butler when they're leaving in, 1889, keep all the furniture exactly as it was. I'll be back in 4 years. And she was. And she planted a big kiss on her husband's cheek for the first time at an inauguration, and the crowd, cheers when he comes back in 1892. The problem is during those 4 years, the country changed. So by the time he becomes president, through no fault of his own, he inherits the worst economic depression in the country's history. As an anti-imperialist, he inherits a crisis in Hawaii where a group of settlers aided by the de facto ambassador depose the Hawaiian queen. And he ends up, having to deal with all these issues he inherits before he can focus on the issues that brought him to come back in the first place. And unlike his first presidency, where he left popular and happy and in love and excited about the post-presidency, he really never fully regains his happiness and he leaves less popular. And so Grover Cleveland's story of a comeback is a reminder that it might feel or seem nice to get the job you once had back, but it is rarely as sweet the second time.
Is it a cautionary tale?
I think it's absolutely a cautionary tale. And
obviously, the subtext here, right? We have a former president who is seeking the nomination of his party, who has a very good chance of getting it and returning to the presidency. Frankly, Donald Trump would be reelected as a lame duck president. What are the other parallels?
So, by the way, this is likely going to be the only the second time in history that you have two presidents running against each other as the nominees of the two major parties. The first time in history that you've had one that lost both the Electoral College and the popular vote return. The fact that this has only happened once in history tells you how far off script we've gone. The difference between 1892 and 2024 is we also have the two oldest candidates in presidential history as two presidents. And so it's hard to look at this situation where they're both less popular than they were 4 years ago. They're both older than they were 4 years ago. The country's gotten more complicated than it was 4 years ago. And look at this situation and ask the question, maybe we have two presidents that just don't want to give up power. Right? It's kind of a good time to ask what to do with ex-presidents. And the problem is, it's not just an election for who's going to win, Biden or Trump. It's an election for who's going to be the next ex-president once and for all. And there's not going to be a huge runway. You're not going to have Herbert Hoover's 32 years of the post-presidency, Carter's 42 plus years of the post-presidency. It's a very different context here.
So what should we do with a post-presidency? Now that you've studied the post-presidencies, now that you've studied the presidencies and constructive second acts, is there a better model?
So I think there's no one monolithic model for what to do with ex-presidents. What's interesting is over time, what we've done is we've given them some things to do that are kind of obligations in those early years, right? They have to write the memoir. They have to give the paid speeches, get their finances, in order, they have to sort of set up their library and their foundation. And that kind of helps them transition. So we've given them kind of an exit package, for lack of a better way of putting it.
And now they have a presidential pension.
They have a presidential pension, which, by the way, Herbert Hoover was the first one to get a presidential pension. He didn't need it. But showing his humility, he had become very close with Harry Truman, even though they were in different parties. And he agreed to take the pension so that his friend Harry Truman wouldn't be humiliated by having to take it with him relinquishing it. Very selfless man, if I do say so myself.
And it's not just for this audience, you're saying.
Yes,
it is. This is as a historian who's studied Hoover. We're going to get to Hoover in a second. I want to come back to what else could be done in the post-presidency after the exit package is in place.
So after ex-presidents get their sort of, exit package of things that we've, as a society, kind of encouraged them to do, the question is, what do they do with the rest of their lives? And, the answer, again, I think part of what this book shows is, there's at least seven different ways to get after it. And those seven different models that I write about, they're acute to the type of personality that someone is. If you're not a serial founder, like Thomas Jefferson, you're unlikely to go build, the next great institution that's going to last 200 plus years. And so, look, I think with, ex-presidents, I don't think we want them wandering around like the disenchanted ghosts that Hamilton worried about. I don't think we want them to be a nuisance to their successors, but I also think we don't want them to fade away and be invisible. There's something magical about the post-presidency because, again, authoritarian systems don't have it. But you need to give them something to do. So I love the sort of image. We have more ex-presidents alive today than we have at any other time in history. It's an incredible opportunity to show national unity. Bipartisanship is something that feels like it's in recession right now. We have presidents of both parties who are alive. Everybody loves the image of, when Bush and Obama get together. There's things that symbolically would have been counterintuitive when they were in office that you can bring alive in the post-presidency. But they also make incredible elder statesmen. And the world's complicated right now. I mean, this is the most difficult geopolitical period we've had in more than two plus decades. Tensions with China, war in the Middle East, war in Europe. We're likely to see more conflicts, not less. The ability to utilize ex-presidents as statesmen and deploy them around the world. It's both a great symbol of democracy. It's also a way to make them pretty useful.
Yeah. I want to get to Jimmy Carter because he's been a model of what you've just articulated and described. But some may question your addition of Herbert Hoover to this group of ex-presidents that you've studied. Of course, I would not question that. And frankly, appreciated that you recognize that Herbert Hoover had a 50 years in public life, four of which were president. But many people may not know that. As a disclosure, you reached out to me at the beginning of your research process, and I was able to connect you to the Hoover Presidential Library, Hoover's biographer, and even a living ex-secretary, ex-research assistant of President Hoover's from his post-presidency. So you actually got to meet and interview and interact with somebody who worked with Herbert Hoover in his post-presidency. What inclined you towards Hoover?
So look, as I was looking at different presidents and which ones to write about, there's an obvious question about Herbert Hoover, which is there's people in life who their reputation will end up in tatters. They'll leave office or they'll leave their job, you know, having sort of this perception of failure lingering around them. And so I was really interested in a story of recovery. And as I dug into Herbert Hoover, I came to appreciate that a man who lived to be 90 years old is basically defined by 3.5 years. The time that the Great Depression happened through the balance of his presidency. And he's as much of a marketing tragedy as anything else, where, you know, his name has just sort of sustained as political fodder. And if you look at Herbert Hoover before the presidency, he had one of the greatest pre-presidential lives of any of the men who've risen to this office. He was once, first of all, an orphan from Iowa, rose to become a self-made millionaire, became, you know, respected and iconic in business, traveled all over the world, upstanding character. He was the great humanitarian who, after World War I, you know, basically fed all of Europe. The world would have been very different if he didn't do that. And even domestically, after the great Mississippi flood of 1927, Herbert Hoover's the one who steps in to provide relief to the largely African-American community that suffered. So when he gets elected president in 1928, Hoover waltzes into the White House. And rarely have you had such a lopsided election and such a foregone conclusion. And in 4 years, it all disappears. And he doesn't understand how quickly and doesn't understand how the American people can forget all of these things that he did. And so he embarks on what I think is one of the most fascinating and honestly seemingly relatable stories of recovery, right? The recovery of his name and the recovery of that path to service that he so enjoyed before being president. I think he probably regretted being president because he had lost all of that. And, you know, in his lifetime, by the time he dies at 90 years old, he once again becomes the great humanitarian. He's resurrected by Harry Truman to feed the world again, this time after World War II. The world gets to remember him as a great businessman and executive, because both Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower bring him in to reorganize the executive branch of government through not one, but two Hoover commissions. And then his final act as a kind of, you know, statesman and man of service is in 1960, Joe Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, asks him to bring JFK and the defeated Richard Nixon together to show national unity. And what people don't realize about Hoover is two things. He does recover his name in his lifetime. It just gets tarnished again posthumously. The other thing about Hoover that's so interesting is from the time he leaves office until he moves on from the idea of returning to elected politics after the 1940 election, he's wrestling between his name and his political future and his desire to serve. And it's when he retires from politics in 1940 that he unburdens himself from the task of recovering his name and focuses just on recovering his platform of service. And he does more to restore his good name by leaning into that latter goal than he does by weighing in and trying to get the presidency back.
You know, it has been 90 years since Herbert Hoover left office, but recently, former President Trump and President Biden have traded barbs, invoking Herbert Hoover as a synonym for economic hard times.
When there's a crash, I hope it's going to be during this next 12 months, because I don't want to be Herbert Hoover. The one president, I just don't want to be Herbert Hoover.
He's already Herbert Hoover. He's the only president other than Herbert Hoover who lost jobs when he was president.
Have you encountered any ex-president who's name has been so enduringly diminished and frankly marginalized?
It's preposterous to me.
But is it unique?
It's with Hoover, it's totally unique. And you look at some of the ex-presidential disasters. I mean, John Tyler defects from the Union as an ex-president. He gets elected to the Confederate House of Representatives. He's the only president to ever literally be a traitor to the Union. When he dies, Lincoln doesn't give him a state funeral. Franklin Pierce, who's a Democrat from New Hampshire, ends up becoming a correspondent of Jefferson Davis and a Confederate sympathizer? Why don't we tarnish their names? Think about how many slave owning presidents that we had. And Hoover, it's the power of marketing.
Well, I want to talk about that marketing, because there was a operative of the Democratic Party called Charlie Michelson, who I imagine is the Roger Stone of his day, right? He's a political trickster, and his job is to tarnish Hoover's name, even before the Great Depression, because they believed that Democrats believed Hoover's name was it was a bubble too big to burst. What did you learn about Charlie Michelson?
Well, I learned that Herbert Hoover had a vase from Asia that he had on his desk that he called Charlie. I think you may have told me that, Margaret.
It was a dragon, and he referred to it. Anyway, yes.
But look, I think what's interesting is when FDR was president, I mean, this really used to weigh on Herbert Hoover tremendously. And FDR runs against Herbert Hoover, four times, no matter who he's running against, right? It's just, Hoover's name is bigger than anyone that FDR is running against. And even though Hoover develops this great personal relationship and partnership with Harry Truman, at the end of the day is kind of a machine politician from Missouri. And, by the time Truman, who also would rather run against Herbert Hoover than, Thomas Dewey or anybody else, is out on the campaign trail. And again, talking about Hoovervilles and talking about Hoover being the only engineer to make things go backwards, Hoover kind of shrugs his shoulders. I mean, he never quite accepts it, but he moves on from it. And I think part of the reason he's able to move on from it is there's the superficiality of your name, and then there's what you get to do because of your name. And what Hoover came to appreciate is they can tarnish me on the campaign trail all they want. They can make political fodder out of it all they want. Because I'm Herbert Hoover and I've done what I've done, they're asking me to feed the world after World War II. They're asking me to organize the executive branch of government. They're asking me to reconcile, two parties that have gone adrift. And I think as he gets older, that matters more to him. But he's a prolific writer. I think one of the ways that he copes with his name being tarnished is he just writes and writes and writes.
38 books in a lifetime. I think more than any president, although T.R., who wrote more books, Hoover or T.R.?
So the three tier one authors of presidents are Hoover, Carter, and T.R. And it depends on what you define as a book, right? There's pamphlets, there's co-authorship, et cetera. But Hoover probably was the most prolific of all the authors, certainly, in terms of the number of years that he lived.
Jimmy Carter and Herbert Hoover have some similarities. They were quite young when they ascended to the presidency. They each had four-year terms from which they were precipitously dismissed from their office. As Hoover always said, democracy is a harsh employer. Jimmy Carter, you write, turned the post-presidency into a lifetime appointment with power of its own. How did Carter approach the role differently?
Well, first of all, Jimmy Carter's successful ex-presidency, in my opinion, does not exist without Herbert Hoover's successful ex-presidency. Herbert Hoover did a lot of the things that Carter did as a former president. He became a statesman. He became a prolific author. He was out there. He criticized, people in both parties. He became, a voice of principle. He just did it without an institution, and he did it without an official platform. He kind of did it ad hoc and on demand. And what Carter does in the post-presidency is he basically creates a post-presidential administration. And it's Jimmy Carter who really invents the idea of the former presidency being a platform in and of itself. And by building infrastructure around it, he architects something that actually finds its roots in Jefferson, but has persisted with every single post-president, for the most part, since Jimmy Carter, is doing some version of what Carter has done, right? They build an institution around their causes. They write, prolifically. They're out there, and Carter transforms the post presidency. He's able to do that because he lives for a long time. But he also makes a decision very early on that he's done running for office. He's not done with politics. He weighs in on everything, and to the great agony of his successors on both sides. But he separates and moves on from political elected life, and that allows him to really focus. And I think as a man of tremendous faith, his faith guided him such that he had this, saying that, as long as I'm alive, I'm commanded to do, whatever I need to do for as long as I need to do it, wherever I need to do it. And that kind of really, shapes the way that he lives his post-presidency.
Doesn't the success of his post-presidency also hinge on the generosity of his successors. It's George H.W. Bush who deploys him to Panama. It's the utility of a former president is really at the behest of the current president.
So it's interesting with Jimmy Carter on, you know, in some respects, the fact that the hostage crisis in Iran ends just after Ronald Reagan takes the oath of office. It kind of inaugurates this idea because Reagan sends him to go greet the hostages. The narrative that the Reagan people told was, you know, it was really Carter's doing getting the hostages out. What they would have said privately and did say privately is they just want to get him out of the country so that he would stop, you know, chirping about things. But what's interesting is, you know, a lot of presidents utilize Carter over the years, and sometimes he plays a constructive role, which he did in Panama during the election where Noriega was trying to put his drug trafficking successor in place, and he behaves valiantly and nobly and consistently with the administration. But there's lots of instances where he doesn't, right? So, a great example of this is right after Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, Jimmy Carter, who's, you know, anti-war, writes letters to multiple members of the permanent, you know, countries at the Security Council, basically urging them not to support the war. Huge faux pas as a former president. And then my favorite anecdote about Carter is, you know, Bill Clinton sends him to North Korea to meet with the great leader and instructs him, look, you're a messenger. You're not to make policy. You're just there as a messenger. But it's a good use of an ex-president. And then Carter, behind closed doors, negotiates a whole, you know, deal. And Clinton finds out about it because Carter goes on CNN talking about the breakthrough deal that he's negotiated. And so, of course, the Clinton people are furious. And so, look, Carter represents an ex-president, and the risk, by the way, of an ex-president who is allowed to be out there
going rogue.
Going totally rogue. And by the way, you know, you compare and contrast Carter with Herbert Hoover. When Herbert Hoover was utilized by ex-presidents, even when he disagreed with them, he stuck with the mission. He saved his disagreements and his agitation for his books and his speeches.
You interviewed George W. Bush in his post-presidency. You learned a lot about his career as a painter, as an artist, his development and into a serious artist. How much of George W. Bush's post-presidency do you think is informed by his father, who was a president and also had his own post-presidency? Because Bush's has been marked, as you write, by quiet introspection and not seeking the public eye.
So I spent 2 days with President Bush in 2020, so in the middle of COVID, really digging into his post-presidency. I watched him paint. We did multiple interviews. And what I wanted to understand was the following, which is if you look at the active living presidents, there's only one whose popularity has doubled since he left office, and it's George W. Bush. And it's kind of an interesting question of how he's managed to accomplish that when he's invested so much less, at least actively speaking, in his legacy than presidents like Bill Clinton and Obama and others.
Is the obvious question that he has been implicitly compared with his Republican presidential successor?
I think it's more complicated than that. So I think let's start with where we should give George W. Bush credit, which is he's done something that no other ex-president has done, which is he has completely separated. The chapter is called Moving On, because a lot of presidents talk about this idea of one president at a time and revering the Washington principle, but they can't resist the urge to occasionally weigh in, occasionally hit the campaign trail, use the name of their successors. George W. Bush doesn't do that. He's never once wavered from it. He has completely moved on from politics.
And in fact, to the extent that he's made speeches to weigh in, he's had to be persuaded.
And he never mentions them by name. And, you know, what's interesting about George W. Bush is when I sat down to interview him, before I even asked a question, he looked at me and he kind of leans in and his kind of Texas accent. He says, you know, you can't long for what you can't have. When it's over, it's over. I don't miss it. And I looked at him and I said, you know what? I think I actually believe him. He's a total chapter guy, right? I mean, he sort of lives his life in chapters, and the chapter of politics was over and he just kind of moved on. And by the way, that agitates people who want him to be introspective about his presidency, who disagreed with his policies. It's just not who the guy is. And so he's managed to do something that no other president has done. It's aged very well in the era of Donald Trump, because there's a juxtaposition of one Republican president adhering to the George Washington principle and the quiet ex-president, and one who, let's just say, has not been. So I think that's a second part of it. I think a third is the lesson from his father was very instructive for him. I think he watched the way his father's legacy got beaten up and the way his father, responded to that in a dignified way as a real gentleman. And I think that that really inspired him to kind of mimic that lesson that his father taught him.
It seems to me that the real reevaluation of George H.W. Bush as a statesman and as a president and as a real diplomat occurred during the presidency of his son, George W. Bush. That there was also a comparison being made in the minds of the public between the father and son and their approaches to many issues. Do you see that?
I absolutely see that. I think this is why George W. Bush decides to write a book about his father. By the way, he's a competitive guy too, and he kind of liked the idea that John Quincy Adams never kind of got around to it or tried to do it and never ended up getting
after. He was too busy being an abolitionist in the House of Representatives, standing up for real issues.
And so his view was, he was very cognizant of the fact that people would compare them and lump them together because they had the same name, and he wanted his father's presidency to be evaluated separately from his own. And it's interesting, Bush has a very quarrelsome view with the idea of shaping legacy, but specifically shaping your own legacy. It agitates him. He thinks it's a selfish word. He thinks it's a dirty word. He has this sort of joke that they're still writing books about the other George. By the time they get around to me, I'll be long gone, obviously referring to George Washington. And so he doesn't admire these people who spend countless hours avoiding and missing out on the present so that they can, invest in a chapter of life that they're not going to be here to see. It just makes no sense to him. But when it comes to the legacy of others, he has a different view of it. And he wanted to write that book. He wanted to write it when his father was still alive. For him, it was as much of a love letter to his father and a message to his father as it was an investment in his father's legacy. And I think it wasn't meant to be, a Pulitzer Prize winning work of history. And I think he didn't care what the critics thought. He accomplished what he wanted to with it. And then the other thing that's amazing about, George W. Bush is there's two things that I think you can learn from him. One, whether you're an ex-president or just, somebody who never rose to be chief magistrate, having this sort of endless learning experience, things that you can do when your knees give out, things that you can do when you become too old and frail, and you can keep learning until the end, is an important part of what keeps you going. And for him, it's painting, right? His painting is not a hobby. He spends 6-7 hours some days, doing it. He has studios in every one of the places that he lives. And what's interesting with the painting is he's discovered a post-presidential voice that allows him to continue advocating for policies that he cares about without undermining his successors. And I think this is also part of why Bush has had a little bit of a resurrection. One, I think the idea of a former president painting is kind of endearing. But I think the other is the subjects that he's painting, veterans and American immigrants. These are subjects that make people remember and feel fondly about some of the lighter sides of George W. Bush.
After leaving office, President Ronald Reagan appeared on the original firing line with William F. Buckley Jr. in 1990 to discuss his memoir, part of the exit package, as you say, An American Life. Here's how Buckley described the 700-page book.
The book is full of intimate glimpses, riding through Windsor Park with the Queen of England, saying hello to the Pope in Alaska, urging Gorbachev to just call him Ron. Yet it is the closest we are likely to get to the history of the 1980s in America, and the closest we will ever get to a portrait of someone who feels it unnatural to draw open the curtain on his private life, and yet succeeds in illuminating that life by giving his reactions to public situations that give him pain and pleasure.
Reagan reportedly signed a $5 million contract with Simon & Schuster for his memoir. Many presidents have had multi-million dollar book deals and big speaking fees around the world. What is your analysis of the commoditization of the post-presidency?
So it's gotten normalized over time, right? I think the idea of presidents getting big book advances, we expect that. The idea of presidents getting, big speaking fees, we expect that. We've now entered a new phase of Netflix deals and business dealings, and, the verdict is still out on whether people are comfortable with that. My view on all the money-making and commoditization of the presidency after one leaves office is How comfortable the public is with it is a function of what else an ex-president does. And I think, look, because I think ex-presidents are a treasure of the republic. They're symbolic of kind of transitions that make a democracy a democracy. I think that if they want to make a lot of money, great. But I think that there is not a founder's obligation like Thomas Jefferson, but I think there is a former leader of the free world obligation to use that station to do something to advance the cause of democracy. And I think as long as ex-presidents embark on something purposeful, something that the American people look at and say, that's what's supposed to happen in a democracy, I think they care very little about the other things.
The feature of an ex-presidency, it's an important aspect of our democracy because it reflects, as you say, the peaceful transition of power. You referenced Hamilton and the Federalist Papers. What did Hamilton and the founders write about those who may be afraid or unwilling to step away peacefully from power?
Look, the founders worried tremendously about the peaceful transfer of power. They didn't take it for granted. They, monarchy was not just in the rearview mirror. It was something they lived through. They had so many issues to contend with in terms of the founding of the republic. And frankly, they had to do the whole thing in haste. They just never got around to answering the question of what to do with ex-presidents. And so, they didn't establish term limits. They had kind of written all the documents. It's Washington who establishes the precedent for two terms. It's not until after FDR's four elections that you have the 22nd Amendment that codifies it, as you can only be elected to the presidency twice.
Do you think it's worth also codifying a formal role for post-presidents?
So look, this is something that the founders debated. Again, it was not high on their list given
it's
all the circumstances.
It's never high on the list until somebody breaks a precedent.
Yep.
FDR broke the two-term precedent. Donald Trump is really agitating with breaking this peaceful transition of power precedent. What if he had a formal role as a post-president?
So I think part of the challenge is to really have a proper, enforceable, formal role for ex-presidents, you would need a constitutional amendment. And the threshold for getting a constitutional amendment passed for anything, by the way, you have a hard time getting a constitutional amendment reaffirming that the sky is blue right now. So I'm skeptical that we'll ever get there. So the question is, can you normatively get there? I think I would have said yes until the sort of current set of circumstances that we're living through. And I think we've not just gone off script in terms of our politics. I think the interesting thing about this current political moment is it's making us go completely off script in terms of what to do with ex-presidents. If you look at the living, active ex-presidents, they have almost nothing in common. I mean, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, they're all getting after it in totally different ways. Some more constructively than others, some less constructively than others. And so it feels like we had sort of gained some consistency in the post-presidency, beginning with Hoover and formalizing it with Carter and, sequentially after that. And it feels like all that consistency is now blown up.
You've spent a lot of time studying the presidency, thinking about American presidents. You're a student of American history and the U.S. presidency. You also have a peculiar collection of relics related to the American presidency. You collect presidential locks of hair. What inspired you to this collection? and how many presidents are represented in your collection?
Well, first of all, I'm not embarrassed by the question, Margaret. And you've seen my locks of presidential hair. And I've said to you before, and I'll say to you and your viewers, that if you're going to collect locks of presidential hair, don't run away from the weirdness of it. You have to kind of really own the hobby. And before anyone thinks it's too weird, people collect autographs. That's not abnormal. But before the 20th century, people didn't ask for autographs. They would write letters to ex-presidents asking them for a lock of their hair. And the autograph that they would get when the hair lock was attached to the letter returning, the autograph was secondary to the lock. And so there is a historic precedent for this. It just got lost in the 20th and 21st century, and I'm trying to bring it back. But I sort of stumbled into it by accident. There's a great autograph dealer and presidential memorabilia dealer named John Resnikoff, who I've gotten to know quite well, and he has the largest collection of historic hair in the world. And for years, he was trying to get me to purchase hair, and I said, I just can't bring myself to do it. And we agreed that when I bought my first Abraham Lincoln signed document, I would get the hair as kind of a kickback.
So you have a strand, a lock of Abraham Lincoln's hair.
I have six strands from the most famous lock of Lincoln's hair taken from him the night of his assassination, which is in this, you know, dealer's collection.
How many locks of presidential hair do you have? How many different presidents are represented in your collection?
I have 11. And before you ask about any of the living presidents, I don't collect the hair of the living. So just to clarify this, I also collect several oddities.
Very 19th century of me.
So Charles Guiteau, who assassinated James Garfield in 1881, when he was arrested and put in prison, his sister sent him a vial of poison so that he would take his own life and spare public hanging. He did not take that poison. It's sitting in my library. So I have the vial of poison. And then I have the original molding for the Dallas Morning News from November 23rd, 1963, the morning after Kennedy was assassinated. And before we sort of, you know, make too much fodder out of the oddities, part of the reason I like these artifacts and these collections, I love history. And, you know, there's something about touching the document that was signed by George Washington, or, you know, looking at the hair of Abraham Lincoln from the night of his assassination. It's the closest we're going to get to physically becoming part of that history and touching that history. And maybe that's kind of overly romantic of me, but I live in my apartment amidst all of these kind of different artifacts and documents, and I feel like I'm living in, you know, kind of a narrative of American history. And as somebody who loves the presidency, as somebody who, you know, thinks a lot about civics, I just like seeing it every day. I like feeling immersed in it. I like my, you know, three daughters, you know, being around it. I have no idea how it's going to manifest when they're older, but at least right now they seem curious about it.
You're doing your part to turn around the education of American civics to our youth. Jared Cohen, the book is excellent. Thank you for your contribution, and thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret.